Now, later this hour, our March edition of A Foreign Affair, where we generally examine the present and the future, but with this shifting world order that we live in, might it be wise to look more to the past? That's what I'd like to discuss now with an experienced hand, the former head of the World Bank and the respected foreign policy official for many years, Robert Selleck. He's appeared on Saturday Extra before, some years back, when he was visiting, I think, for one of the ANU's Crawford Forums. Mr. Selleck was Deputy Secretary of State under President George W. Bush and learned much of his diplomatic craft at the side of a man he thoroughly admires, former Secretary of State James Baker. He's now a senior fellow at the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and the author most recently of an ambitious work, America in the World, A History of US Diplomacy and Foreign Policy, a fascinating study of the ideas and impulses that he believes have shaped US foreign policy for over 200 years, of the individuals who put in the hard yards to solve some of modern history's thorniest problems, and of the need now to emphasise a US sense of purpose rather than exceptionalism in its outward focus. I think that's the conclusion he's drawn. I'll check with him. Bob Selleck, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Well, thanks, Geraldine. I'd be delighted to be with you. I'm sorry to read about the floods, and I know about the fires and plagues, so I guess with a sense of history, since this is Passover weekend, if Moses says, let his people go, I'd advise you do so.
Oh, boom, boom. I was going to do, we have a marvellous poet called Dorothea McKellar who talks about Australia as the land of droughts and flooding rain. So it has been with us for a long time, but it's been pretty hard to watch, I must say, of late.
No, it's tough on people.
Oh, shocking. Shocking. I understand this book of yours had its genesis over 25 years ago. Can you start by telling us what inspired it, please?
Sure. So when I was in government, I often drew upon history and thinking about problems. And so part of my idea here was to encourage others, particularly a younger generation, to take this approach. And many people have taken foreign policy courses know that they often focus on international relations theories. And they're fun and intellectually challenging to play with. But it, in my experience on issues as diverse as German unification or trade or China policy or Darfur, they were actually of too much use. So what this book focuses on is the experience of practical problem solving. And what you're referring to there is Henry Kissinger wrote a book in mid-90s titled Diplomacy, where he used history in foreign policy. But it intended to write from the European realpolitik perspective. So I wanted to have a book that focused on some of the American experience and ideas. And I suppose the last thought was that, you know, over the years I've often had younger colleagues and maybe I used to torture them by asking history questions because I didn't know how much they do. And insofar as they did, they tended to go from World War II on. And there's some fascinating people and events in the first 150 years. So that's what led me to write the book.
Yeah, one of the themes you draw out is that from its earliest days, and you think this needs articulating, America's foreign policy has been tied to its economic interests, which was different, I think, to Europe. Now, can you draw out why that matters so much?
Yeah, well, it actually starts, I mean, Australians know America pretty well, and you probably remember Thomas Jefferson with the Declaration of Independence in 1776. Well, it turns out that same year, John Adams chaired his own committee, and it dealt with the Model Treaty of the United States in 1776. And if you go back and you look at it, it's basically a trade agreement. And the point is that from the very founding of the United States, I think trade was seen as more than economic efficiency. It was the way we connected with the world. And recall, at that time, this is a world of empires and mercantilism. And so the notion was to open the world to private sector actors. And so a lot of the world that Australians and Americans operate in with transnational actors, whether government or non-governmental, sort of comes from that logic and that experience. And then also I have one of my first chapters actually is about Alexander Hamilton. Ah. And that was conscious because he was a Secretary of the Treasury, not a Secretary of Foreign Affairs. And he was known primarily, obviously, for building the United States credit, because he saw that as a part of national power. And what I talk about in that chapter is how he tried to have a diplomatic strategy that matched what he was trying to do economically. So for Australia, where you have a Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, this won't be news, but in the U.S. context, it's important to bring back to attention.
Actually, the musical starts tonight in Sydney, Hamilton. I saw a preview last week.
Seeing.
Oh, it's fantastic. And, of course, he wanted the US to be a commercial partner with Britain, you make the point, but he couldn't achieve a partnership. So he turned to what I'd like to discuss now. He turned to neutrality, which is something you emphasise, that we tend to forget that even though at the moment it looks like the hegemon, you know, at the head of all of these different alliances, NATO, the Australian-American alliance and so on, that's a relatively recent phenomenon in American foreign policy history, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you really nailed the point. Many people tend to think prior to the alliance period that the U.S. was isolationist. And I take a contrary view, because I think what you see, George Washington, the first president, made a statement about having no permanent alliances. And then Jefferson talked about no entangling alliances. And what my book tries to describe is, of course, the United States was interacting with the world over that period until 1947-49. First, we focused on our continent, but we had to deal with Brits and French and Spanish and Russians, as well as obviously the sad story of Native Americans. But also economics, international law, balance of power politics, arms control and its relation to regional trade. And even in our Civil War, which was the preservation of the Union, I found it really contributed to thoughts about sort of confederal models internationally. And so the 47-49 period was the key one in terms of how we created this alliance order that most of us have grown up in. And what I describe is it was not a grand strategy. People were trying to solve the problems of Europe. They had the idea of the Marshall Plan, but that wouldn't work without Germany, so they created the Federal Republic of Germany. Once they did that, they had Western Europeans worried about Germany and the Soviets, so they created NATO. And so for the 70 years after that, we've worked in this alliance system that has had to continue to adapt. And you can see that today with the efforts of the Biden administration.
Well, that's very interesting, because you say neutrality, and you advise us, neutrality doesn't mean disengagement. In fact, it's almost as if it was a key diplomatic challenge to avoid entanglements, to stay out of the European problems. And if you're right in that assessment, then, of course, that would explain a little bit, I think, why America doesn't necessarily seem super comfortable with some of the involvements they're in at the moment. I mean, obviously, President Trump, I don't want to get sidelined by him, but he clearly didn't want anything to do with NATO. He was visibly uncomfortable. He wanted to be out of it. Now, you'd say that this is all part of that this last 70 years has been the anomaly, in fact. Would you?
Well, what in a sense the United States came up with, and this is my kind of view of problem solving, because it came up really just in response to dealing with issues, was a different type of alliance system. So Americans associated alliances, as you mentioned, with the old European order, and they associated with sort of militarism and empires, and they wanted to avoid that. But so the alliance system that starts out with NATO and expands with Japan and Australia and others in the Pacific and South Korea is really a different design. And it's a design that combines the security and economics, tends to involve open societies and democracies, but not always. And the key point I try to explain is it's not static. It always, you know, at the end of the Cold War, we had to go through adaptations. There'll be adaptations today. And in that sense, Trump, I think, was the outlier, because Trump was very transactional, and he tended to focus things narcissistically on himself. And so one of the challenges we have today is kind of how do we restore those alliances in a different era?
Well, indeed. And one of the challenges that we talk about a lot here in Australia is the challenge of China, a new emerging or a re-emerging a civilization. And the question that some of our really, key commentators, people like Hugh White, who I know you've dealt with here in Australia, say, can America share the space? Now, this is not it's absolutely not an alliance, anything but can America share the space, having become used to prominence and dominance, Can it share the space with another group coming through who might be its equal or certainly near equal?
Well, I would suspect from what I read in Australia, the question may be, can China share the space with the rest of you out there if I look at the way they've been bullying some people in the neighborhood? But it's a reasonable point about the question of, you know, how you create an international system that recognizes that China has different politics. It's a communist authoritarian system. Xi Jinping has clearly emphasized that in sort of recent years. It's grown to be a power. There are clearly areas where we're going to have to work with China, whether it's issues of climate or biological security or the international economy. But we also need to be able to have the security and deterrence system to be able to push back. And at times, I still believe you can work with China on sort of common interests. And that brings you right back to this alliance system, because unlike Trump's view, the U.S. historically was most effective if it could work with partners. So you're not going to be able to, frankly, deter Chinese action against Taiwan unless you've got some cooperation from Japan. And those are some of the issues that we'll be facing going forward. And as for the China part, you know, the interesting part of the American experience, and this goes back to, I have chapters with John Hay in The Open Door, we've had sort of like three different themes. One is sort of the commercial opportunities in China. So there's a story about a ship called the Empress of China, even before we created our constitution, that sort of opened the door for sort of the dream of the Chinese market. And I have a book in my basement that's from the 1930s saying 400 million customers, so the dream of China economy. And that vision was always just a little bit over the horizon. Having said that, you know, as in the case of Australia, it was our fastest growing export market for about 15 years. So that's one theme. The second is recognizing China as a potential power. So back around 1900, you know, John Hay and the United States were trying to maintain China's territorial integrity. People often forget that the Europeans and Japan and Russia were, in a sense, threatening to carve it up like they had done to Africa. And the U.S. view was that China needed to sort of keep whole. We did the same thing in the 20s. After World War II, Franklin Roosevelt sort of envisioned China being one of the four policemen. You could look at Nixon and Kissinger as part of that. And then so the question is, how does China fit in the system as a power today? But there's a third aspect that people often forget, which is for the United States, missionaries were very important in our interaction with China. In a sense, from the start, we were trying to convert the Chinese, whether to Christianity or capitalism or small-R republicanism. And these missionaries became quite important in the American image of China. Their children came back. Pearl Buck wrote the book The Good Earth and the movies. Their children became the diplomats. So I guess what I'd conclude is it's important to recognize China for what it is, not what we want it to be. But as your question suggests, you also have to figure out, you know, what can be the accommodation in China's place in the regional and world system without conceding to China.
Have you got an answer? I mean, I'm not trying to be glib here, but...
I think it's... Well, I... this is a minority view in the United States now, but I gave a speech in 2005 where I talked about pushing China to become a responsible stakeholder. I didn't say China was a responsible stakeholder, but I was saying China's in the WTO, it's in the World Bank, it's in the IMF, it's in the UN Security Council. So I was pushing China to share some of the responsibilities of the international system, which had benefited China. I think under Xi Jinping, you've seen China take sort of a dual approach. One, they work within the system, and they're trying to push it in their direction. That really isn't a surprise. The surprise, as you alluded to, was that Trump, in a sense, pulled the United States out of it. Mm. Now it's coming back in. But then there's a model that Australians know, sort of the Chinese tributary state, which is kind of the Belt and Road model, which is that if you behave well, you can get the benefits. If you don't, we'll smack you. And that's a different model. And so I think the point with China is you're going to have some points of cooperation, some points you need to deter, some points you have to manage disputes. There's no one formula for a country as big as important as China. Where I would differ, say, with the Trump people is, Trump kind of focused first on a bilateral managed trade deal, and he actually didn't focus on structural reforms in China. And frankly, the deal has only been about halfway performed anyway. And then when COVID hit, his administration shifted to basically confrontation and condemnation. That's not the same as competition. And so what you see the Biden administration doing is they're trying to shift rhetorically. They don't want to look soft on China. They want to build their relations with their alliance partners first. But then they're going to have to explore how we get some off-ramps with some of these conflict points.
Yeah, interesting. Bob Zelik is my guest, a respected international official and now commentator and former president of the World Bank. Now, an important aspect of your book is looking at the art, or rather the business, and you've just emphasized that, of diplomacy. After looking so intently at all these past statesmen, and you really believe history does offer all sorts of guides that are not properly plumbed, what's the conclusion you've drawn? What makes a successful diplomat, in your opinion?
Well, I emphasize the theme of pragmatism. And, you know, some people know that actually this is probably the main American contribution to the field of philosophy, William James and Dewey. But I apply this in a diplomatic context. And the idea here is a lot of, again, foreign policy thinking tries to come up with abstractions or somewhat artificial converges, even dogmas. And what I'm emphasizing by pragmatism is results over theories, the practical consequences that flow from experience and seeking out what works. And you mentioned I worked for James Baker for 8 years. He was kind of the master pragmatist. And what this means in diplomacy is you have to focus on the realities on the ground. Issues of power, economics, military, technology, sometimes votes. You need to know the processes and institutions and how they work. And we've talked about some of those just even in the past few minutes. You need to know the positions of others because you're not going to be able to dictate everything. And you need to have a sense of timing. So in a sense, what my book is about is trying to sort of go beyond the headlines or the slogans and say, let's look at each individual situation as a case and how did people manage these problems? And I suppose there's one other piece of that I've discovered talking to some university audiences that's encouraging, is that it has a certain optimism by saying history can offer insights on how to do better as opposed to acceptance of timeless obstacles. And look, imperfect results in a far from perfect world can be a good day. We're not going to have perpetual peace, so you have to just sort of take each step as you can.
Mm. And yet, of course, we had, you know, the gutting of the State Department under Trump. And you know, and here it's been well recorded that our Department of Foreign Affairs has lost out. Others, particularly the security establishment, has absolutely risen and the diplomats have dropped. It's as if soft power, or perceived soft power, however you define it, hasn't been seen to be as important as hard power in recent times.
Well, I don't just associate foreign policy only with the State Department. As I mentioned, you know, we talked about the Treasury Department as sort of a starting point. I have a chapter on a man named Vannevar Bush in science and technology. But clearly, you want to have a strong foreign affairs system. The challenge is, how do you bring these strands together? And that goes back to the sort of the practical point about understanding power and influence and ideas. I use a chapter on Lyndon Johnson and the mistakes he made in late 1964 and early 65 in terms of taking over the ground war in Vietnam to explain some of the dangers of overbelief about sort of military power and the need to connect it to your diplomacy. Kissinger often makes a point that the American view is you fight a war and then you turn to diplomacy. And obviously, both he and I would agree you need to connect these two. So I don't mean to undermine military power. The world of China's expansion, frankly, we're going to need to have a different posture for our military power, including with our allies, such as Australia. But it's not the end-all and be-all. You need other aspects, economic, technological, and the values and ideas we stand for.
Interestingly, Richard Haass, who's another very interesting foreign policy analyst in the United States, had a piece recently just saying that businesses, in his view, businesses need their own foreign policy effectively, that we are entering the sort of world, which I presume you might even agree with, where they need to have, as well as the chief financial officer, you know, someone who's really skilled on some of these international issues.
Well, it's interesting. I have a business life as well with various boards and advisory, and obviously, you know, companies are trying to figure out how do they navigate relations with China and Hong Kong. As you go to the Glasgow COP on climate change, many companies are trying to figure out how they're going to position on that. Obviously, with COVID, now we've also learned something about the different nature of the supply chains. And then, of course, this brings you right back to the trade topic, because trade, as I would practice it, is also about developing the rules and norms for digital trade and how you deal with data and a series of other issues. So I think one of the things I've noticed for CEOs is that they need to expand their horizontal perspective on these sort of full range of issues, plus the other ones that you see about diversity and millennial workforce and others. So it's become a harder job. I'm not saying they should be paid more, but it goes with the turf.
Look, a lot must depend on the image you bring with you as a diplomat and the nature of your own sense of the country you represent. And this would seem to me to be something very difficult for the US. And, you know, at the moment, we're about to go to a segment we call a foreign affair, where we talk about the fact that the East clearly believes, you know, China believes it's rising and the West is in decline. And does this affect the way negotiations go? And I want to read you a really tough piece that was a review piece done by a book by a man called Nick Bryant. And the review piece was by a colleague of mine, Andrew West. Was a country that denied, this is talking about the US, full citizenship to African Americans until the mid-1960s, and that led the world in the concentration of obscene wealth by the top 0.1%, ever really great? The United States was certainly powerful and feared, but it was late in entering both world wars and then bullied its way into wars that should never have happened: Vietnam, Central America, Afghanistan, Iraq. Now, that, you know, that's a strong critique that you hear quite a lot of these days. Does that...
So we'll put him down as undecided?
You what? What did you say?
I said we'll put him down as undecided. I was.
Yeah, but I wonder whether it affects, whether it does. Does America, you make the point, that's what I said at the start, that a sort of exceptionalism that has guided American foreign policy, together with a lot of these things that you're talking about, that may not be sufficient to take America into the next stage. Now, what you say it might need a new purpose, if I read you correctly?
Yeah, well, first on the basic point, look, you know, I'd be the first to recognize that, you know, one of the challenges for the United States is all societies, Australia does this with its Aboriginal population, is you want to do better. And slavery is a terrible sin on our experience. On the other hand, I don't see a shortage of foreigners wanting to come to the United States. And I guess from a narrower Australian perspective, probably a friendship with the United States was probably pretty useful in 1942. So I'm sorry for the bad parts, but there were some good parts, too. I mean, you could take that apart. I mean, we didn't go into World War One because, frankly, we were trying to preserve a neutral sort of peacemaking system. I talk about a possibility that the United States might have done in 1916 to help sort of mediate the end of the war. But so whether you call it soft power, whether you call it sort of democracy and values, look, my belief is always on, and by the way, also on the idea of sort of U.S. weakness. I went through this with Japan in the 1920s or the 1980s. They were going to dominate the world. You know, we'll let the chips fall where they may. I personally think that the private sector in the United States, the innovation, and then also Australia has the same feature, which is that, you know, you're open societies. So we don't know what's going on in criticism in China because we can never hear about it. In fact, they're trying to shut down people overseas. Our societies are open, and that's the way that they should be. And that's how my belief, and again, a contrast with Trump, is that our strength is our openness to people, ideas, to capital, to goods, to sort of improving our position. And I think it's a mistake for us to try to follow China in terms of shutting things down. As for the notion of purpose, it's an interesting one. As you properly point out, some Americans use the term exceptionalism. And as I was road testing this book in an early phase, I had a seminar at Johns Hopkins School of International Affairs. And actually, it was an Australian Army colonel that sort of said, you use term exceptionalism. Everybody thinks they're exceptional, you know. And he actually persuaded me not to use that term. But there, what I wanted to explain, since it's a history, was that there's clearly always been a notion in the United States about a larger sense of purpose. And the best anecdote I could find for this is, you know, for those of you that still carry cash and U.S. dollars, someday take out the back of a dollar bill and look at what's the Great Seal of the United States. And you'll see this unfinished pyramid. Note it's unfinished. And there's an eye of providence above it. And below it says Novus Ordo Seclorum, New Order of the Ages. So my simple point was, from the very start of the United States, people were trying to create a new nation state, but they also had this idea of a larger purpose. And I think it changes over time. At first, it was just to survive as a republic. Then we had to preserve our union. We had to deal with the other issues that your complainants sort of listed. And I suspect over time, it's a combination of the external context, public opinion in the United States, and some notion of a larger purpose of liberty and freedom and human rights. But that's what political leadership is about.
And look, that's a fabulous summary. But do domestic, someone who does deal well with the domestic and changes the conversation internally in America, is that sort of person necessarily the person who can deal on the world stage? I mean, that is a real dilemma. You look at LBJ, brilliant internal politician, turned out not to be externally.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. And one of the traditions I talk about is the importance of public opinion and congressional support for a successful foreign policy. Many foreign policy experts ignore this. I mean, Kennan, who is a very wise man, you could see why they never let him go talk to Congress, because he basically was disdainful of them. But someone like Lincoln said, you know, public opinion is everything in this country. And if you have it behind you, you can succeed greatly. So, again, trying to bring this down to the practical experience. In the 47-49 period, I talk about a man named Senator Vandenberg, who was a Republican, who was critical helping the Democratic Truman. And I explained a little bit how he did it congressionally. And if you think in more recent years, you know, whether it's people like Senator Lugar and Nunn or McCain or others, that's an important part of crafting a successful foreign policy. And to give Australia its due, you know, including with your most recent U.S. ambassador, A.B. Kolbehaus, you had congressional delegations come over, and I've been part of some of these efforts. It's important to stay in touch with the broader aspects of the public and society, and that's where Australia, frankly, has a huge benefit because, you know, Americans like Australia. And so that's something not to ignore, by the way, as an asset.
No.
And when I negotiated a free trade agreement with Australia and it came time to get votes, trust me, that was a plus.
Look, thank you so much, Bob Zoellick. It's been terrific to have you on, and thank you for joining us.
It's a delight, and good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Good weekend.
Okay. Bob Zoellick, Zoellick, and his book is America in the World, A History of U.S. Diplomacy and Foreign Policy. It's published by Hachette.